G'day, humans. Welcome to the safe space for dangerous ideas. Here's a dangerous idea for you. We're all getting soft. We're all getting too soft to be able to have real, vigorous debates anymore. Some cultures can do it. The French, for example, still seem capable of figuring out how to disagree as an art form, how to actually cultivate the craft of disagreement and argumentation in a civil environment. But that we in the Anglosphere have lost that knack. We just squabble in predictable ways. It was that sense of a kind of civilizational decline, that sense of being on a treadmill to nowhere, that caused today's guest, Sarah Wilson, to pack it all in. She had it all. She was the editor of Cosmopolitan magazine in Australia. She was a host of MasterChef, the television show. She was a wellness columnist and had millions of readers. And then she sold everything and she traveled the world. She's now a nomad. She doesn't have a house. She is based in Paris because that is the place where people can still argue. And this is an example of an argument in itself. Sarah and I disagree on a lot. We have a kind of a mutual respect, a long-standing relationship, a kind of an intellectual friction, I suppose. And we're both on Substack. So this week, we jumped on Substack Live and we live-streamed to her fans and mine. This is a slightly unusual episode in the sense that it's not as buttoned up. It's not pre-recorded like the normal podcast is. It's a taste, really, for you to see what it's like and the kinds of stuff that we're experimenting with over on Substack if you haven't already joined us there. We talk about everything from how population collapse could cause civilizational decline to how much to blame the woke left or the Trumpists for the decline of conversation. I love Sarah. I loved this conversation. I hope you enjoy as much as I did. The one, the only, Sarah Wilson. Such a shame we didn't get to catch up in Europe. I was just in Amsterdam and I hit up old Sarah and I was like, should come up to Amsterdam for the weekend and get dinner. It's a little far. I get it. It's a little far.
Be a bit hectic. And you have this idea as an Australian that you can just jump on a train, you know?
Sure.
And then again, the bureaucracy of buying a ticket.
Oh, come on. That's not that hard. Buying a train ticket from Paris to Amsterdam. I can do that on my phone in 3 seconds.
No, it's not. I'm sad to have missed the opportunity as well because it is always a conversation between you and I, between you and anyone, really.
Well, that's true. And between you and anyone.
Probably.
So tell us about this turret or tower that you were in. I mean, when you say that you're in a tower in Paris, it brings up kind of like Gaullist or medieval ideas about where you might be.
Well, the beam suggests as such. I'm on the 7th floor, and anyone who's been to Paris before, you would know that a lot of apartments don't have a lift, an ascenseur. So I walk up, and the final floor is like a little spiral staircase, and it's kind of storage. It's where the maids used to live, and they up under the tin roof, where if it is 30 degrees outside, it's 40 degrees inside. So I've been sweating it out in here, and it's just a temporary place because, as you know, Josh, I was gonna say on the run.
She's on the lam.
I live nomadically, so I float around, but I'm actually trying to find somewhere more permanently, but I'll do it after the summer. Anyone European summer knows there's no point doing anything between now and the end of August, so I'm gonna be flying around, hiking, speaking at a few festivals in the UK, that kind of thing. And this is just a temporary thing that I've rented off some academic. There's a website where they, if they're in Japan on a sabbatical, you can take over their place. So that's what I'm doing. I can sleep anywhere. I can live in absolute grungy circumstances as long as it's quiet and I'm away from all the humans. And up here, I'm literally, there's no common walls. I've got a view of the whole. I'd turn this around, but it'll cause chaos so that you could see outside. But you can see the Eiffel Tower, Notre Dame, the whole thing. So it's pretty amazing.
You're essentially a pigeon up there. You get to look down at everything and feel safe because you're perching. Or like my cat who gets up on her little perch on one of those little things and likes to be able to look down on everybody else, make sure that there's no danger coming from above. You essentially need to make sure that the only things that could be attacking you are bald eagles, but nothing from the ground. I understand that instinct.
Yeah, and also it's you know, it's kind of that the princess in the ivory tower. Everybody's got to climb up to meet me, and thankfully most of them don't make it, so I'm left alone. I can descend down and have a coffee every now and then, but yeah,
it's great.
Quite like being isolated.
The thing I admire about your lifestyle, many things, Sarah, but one in particular is, what do you do with all your shit? Have you got rid of all your shit? Where's your shit?
I haven't owned shit in years, Josh. Great. When about 35, I was the editor of Cosmo, and I quit and I took off, sold off all of my stuff and what I could pack into a car. And I went up to the, as you do, to the forest in the northern, well, up in northern New South Wales, and lived up there. And gradually just wore everything out. So I'm still wearing stuff from when I was 18. I'm now 51. And I just sort of rotate my clothes. So I've got one suitcase with me now and one backpack. And that's what I live out of.
And I love it. It's so glamorous. It's so Hemingway. It's so like on the road. So Kerouac, I should say. It's very.
Yeah. So I can just pack things up and I'm taking a suitcase over to a friend's house, but the rest I'll just take with me for the summer. It'll have my tent. Right. It'll have my little camp stove. It'll have a couple of changes of clothes so that I can do presentations, go hiking. But yeah, I've been like I've been living like this for so long. The Daily Mail likes to pick up on the fact that, and let's put it out there again in case they pick up on it again, that I have about 3 pairs of underpants at a time. So rinse
it. Great.
Yeah,
I'm a big fan of that. I'm a big fan of that as well. I mean, I'm the kind of person who, like, you know how, you know, so I'm happen to be married to the kind of person who, when going on a weekend away, will take like almost comically large quantities of luggage. Like, you know, it's like almost White Lotus levels of like dragging gigantic pink suitcases full of like, and you know, what could you, I don't even know what, even if you asked me to fill those things, I wouldn't even know what to put in them. What am I putting? Saucepans? What are we carrying? Pets? Live iguanas? So it has now become a matter of pride to me that I am the member of the household who will go on a 4-week trip to North America in the middle of winter and only take a carry-on luggage. But the idea of actually going as far as you have and turning my entire life into that is still like, it's almost like, to me, it's imagine going fully vegan raw food for me. You know, it's like something I would love to believe that I am capable of doing. And yet I'm too much of a fallen human being, Homo sapien, to pull off.
Yeah. I mean, I guess the difference is I don't bang on about it. Actually, I probably do. People are fascinated by it. I was going to say, I don't.
Well, it is interesting. It is interesting. But you get a pass. You get a banging on pass when people are asking you all the time about it. I think if people are asking you, then you have a get out of jail free card. If people are just joining us, Sarah Wilson's internet connection is a little unstable today, as indeed is Sarah Wilson all the time, wouldn't you say, Sarah? I'll just banter for one moment while your internet connection recovers. I see that people are already commenting and asking questions. Sarah Peggy says, Josh, you wrote an article in The Age about Israel a week ago, and it was quite offensive and very uninformed. I would like to debate this with you. Thank you, Peggy. I appreciate the offer. You'll be delighted to hear that I've just recorded an editorial about the article and the reaction to the article and the strikes on Iran, which will come out overnight Australian time. So within 24 hours, you'll be able to hear me opine for an entire hour, which will, I'm sure, answer all of your questions. Very controversial, Sarah, apparently, to argue that diaspora Jews should perhaps think independently instead of being perfectly synonymous with the IDF.
I was wondering how much flack you copped from that. That's a big one. And I applaud you for putting that idea out there, because it's been in the back of my mind, but I obviously can't write a piece like that. I'm not Jewish. I hate to imagine what would happen if I postulated that idea outside of my own private sort of, you know, friendship circles. But bravo, Josh. I think whether people agree with it or disagree with it, I think it's a perspective that needs to be put out there, because it's been dangling. There's an elephant in the room, and it's a big one. I mean, it's really difficult for me to sort of speak about it to an Australian audience, because over here, these kinds of things can be spoken about. You can actually have these debates in the street, at cafes, in public, and the intellectual side of it is debated rather than sort of, you know, personal histrionics and stuff like that. So, but in Australia, I'm very, very aware. It's extremely difficult territory to even venture into, especially for a white middle-aged woman who's not Jewish.
Yeah, yes. But do you find that in France the conversation is genuinely open-minded, or is it closed-minded in another way, which is that to be reflexively anti-Israel is the acceptable position, and to have a nuanced position about, well, maybe I believe in Zionism, but I don't believe in the settlements, or, you know, maybe I believe like in the occupation as long as the Palestinians aren't willing to acknowledge Israel as a, like, is there grey, or is it just like, well, I mean, it's a shitty little Zionist state?
I would say that obviously, like the rest of the world, it's changed over the last 2 years. You know what I mean? Like, I think there was a lot more grey happening 18 months, 2 years ago, and progressively that's shifted as the war has progressed. But I would say that the French, they say here that if you get invited to a dinner party, bring a good bottle of wine and a good argument. And really, they're in it for the argument. They really do. I'd say that as the first point. But then I would also say that what's happening in Israel and Palestine, it's huge here at the moment. There's protests on all the time that are about, you know, free Palestine. But I would say that the French cover a whole range of issues. And the French are able to accept that the world is a complicated and complex place. And so they're able to actually hold nuances. They're able to actually discuss different world geopolitics without getting really, really worked up. So even if they've got an entrenched point of view, they don't go absolutely mental as a debate. I was watching something with two toddlers, and it was somebody was analysing these two French toddlers having an argument, and they could barely speak French. They were doing made-up French, you know. And I was saying, here is a classic example of two people having a French argument. And the way that it works is that people don't shout over the top of each other. So he's commentating, going, observe, they don't shout over the top of each other. They listen to each other's point. They're robustly engaged. It doesn't matter what they're talking about. You know, it's fiery and worked up. But it doesn't get personal, doesn't get, you know, over a certain threshold. So I'd say that's the difference, is they can maintain these ideas because they're used to debating complex ideas.
Yeah, I completely get that. And I do you think it's gotten worse over the past 5 or 10 years in countries like Australia? I mean, I don't know if I'm just wistful towards a past that never actually existed and things were equally tribal and the time in which my parents were in their middle age. But I do have a sense that, and my sort of theory of the case is that it's become harder and harder for us to figure out what's going on in the world because of the breakdown of legacy media and the rise of social media and the splintering of all of our information ecosystems. There have been a bunch of taboos on both the right and the left. The right has its obvious taboos, Israel being one of them, but the left has its taboos in terms of social justice and cancel culture and kind of woke ideas and things that you're not supposed to say. And therefore, we've lost the knack of respectfully wrestling with ideas because the penalties are too high if you accidentally trigger the tripwire or, you know, trip over the taboo. Or, you know, so we're all treading on eggshells and we no longer really know how to hear an idea that we hate without it feeling like a personal affront and like the person who's articulating it must be not just wrong or misguided, but evil and, you know, worthy of being shut down or dismissed.
I'd say there's three factors because I've thought about this a fair bit because you do the whole comparathon, you know, between Australia and Europe. The first thing is that Murdoch media obviously dominates. And so you do have tribalized media in Australia more so than probably over here. Obviously, it exists around the world. The second thing is the absolute opulence. I think opulence basically necessitates quite lazy, flaccid thinking. Also, a lack of ability to actually hear other points of views. So, it's been it's been just a little over 3 decades of uninterrupted economic growth in Australia. And sure, there's been slight blips and there's a cost of living crisis, I understand, going on in Australia at the moment. And it's legit for those who are actually experiencing it. But the middle class has always been far more comfortable and very much protected from, say, the GFC, this kind of thing, even COVID, didn't actually have a huge economic.
That's the financial crisis.
That's right, the global financial crisis for American viewers. Because
good
I know
to see you still using your Aussie lingo. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah.
The GFC, the global financial crisis.
Yeah, that's it. We've got to shorten everything. But that kind of populism that comes, mining boom, etc., means that there's just not a need to actually question things and go down deeper. And I think, coupled with an anti-intellectualism that has always existed. So I think it has always existed. I know in the 70s, of course, lots of intellectuals left and for similar reasons to what we're talking about now. And then I think, the third reason is that the schooling system and the whole way that, the system has operated as a result of 30 years of opulence means that debating and ideas are just not treasured. The schooling system here in France is like, from what I understand from my friends who've got kids in it, is like the 1970s. It's strict. You must have firm ideas on things. You must be able to debate it. So kids grow up actually, debating ideas. And I see parents on those bikes, because everyone rides a bike here, it'll be a whole family on a bike, and they're having a big old debate going down the street. And I can only catch bits of what they're talking about, but they're really reasoned arguments. It'll be a three-year-old going, and the parents will go, and that is the culture. And the schooling system operates this way. So I think that everything's been kind of homogenized down. Everyone gets, awards for just turning up. And this idea of robustly engaging in stuff is just not part of our culture now. And I think the main reason is that opulence.
Yeah, I think you and I have disagreed on this before, because I find it a bit materialistically sort of simplistic to blame opulence. Like, there's certainly a kind of a comfortable conformism. And I don't know if it's caused by opulence or if it's just caused by the sort of ethos of she'll be right. And maybe you need both of those ingredients in order for it to take place. But I certainly know a lot of places where there's hardship, material hardship, but not broad-minded or deep thinking. And you can certainly think of places that are prosperous, but, have boisterous levels of intellectual disagreement, like the northeast of the United States or, I don't know, Scandinavia or something. There's something about Australia, like Aussies are just very concerned with maintaining an even keel and not rocking the boat and keeping things nice. You don't want to upset anybody. You don't want to rock the boat too much. You want to make sure that, that you're in with the right crowd. And I just think that in addition to schooling, the French in particular have a home life that is much more animated by the art of overt, boisterous conflict and, almost Socratic challenging of each other. And it's something that I'm very comfortable with because my dad was a European refugee who grew up in Paris and had that whole ethos of sitting around the dining room table and debating the nature of the cosmos and, the existence of God and whatever. It's also quite a Jewish thing, I got to say, like this sort of the training of this kind of Talmudic, aggressive engagement with ideas. And Aussies are just not on this. I mean, maybe it's an Anglo thing. I mean, it may be, but then, like the Irish have it as well, but maybe the Brits don't, and maybe it's the British strain of Australianism that lacks it.
I think it is a perfect storm, but I think you're actually taking things in isolation rather than seeing the whole sort of system. Australia as a system is an opulent place, right? And so the levers of intellectual thinking, the things that actually dictate what determines intellectualism, have become flaccid. Basically from too much ease. That's the way I see it. Now, of course, you can take little pockets out and go, yes, there's working class sections in, Parramatta where they're really having great debates, sure. But as a culture, that is not the vibe. And I think that, there's lots of studies that have been done to show the connection between wealth, a wealthy country, and a lack of curiosity. And I think that's got a bit to do with it as well. When I was growing up in the 90s, I actually do think Australia was a lot more curious because sort of media exposed us to what was happening in the rest of the world, but we were isolated. So we always wanted to know what was going on out there. We were the largest consumers of media. When I was the editor of Cosmopolitan, Australians were reading more magazines than anyone per capita in the world, and were the biggest uptakers of new technology because we were always reaching outwards. So I think technology's part had a part to play in this, because we're not as curious because everything comes to us, like this as a tumbling sort of vomiting of information as it does in the rest of the world. So we just don't have that that yearning to go out there and learn about the rest of the world.
I think the other technological factor here is the fact that social media and the internet has led Australia to an overconsumption of American-based content because we're in the Anglosphere. So we're inheriting or wrestling with a lot of our own issues through the prism of American culture. And in particular, I think the last 10 years that's been damaging, because America has become so hot. And during certainly the social justice reckoning, which I think also then gave rise to Trump, and like these are extremely toxic cultural movements. And for Australians to be sort of pushing all of their own ideas about big issues like climate change or Gaza or whatever it might be through the prism of American social justice or American Make America Great Againism is not helpful, and does it cause a tribalism and a groupthink where Aussies are more their first instinct when they talk to you or when they read a piece like my piece in The Herald and The Age is to think, what tribe are you in? What side are you on? Instead of, what is it that you're saying? How can I critique it? What do I agree with or disagree? Like, where is the nuance? Where's the space for agreement? Like, how exactly do we differ? Let's basically use repartee and discourse and dialogue as a way to communally reach some sort of higher conclusion, rather than you've said something that is dissenting and you're a heretic and so you're out.
Well, so you've picked up on something there that I think really comes down to, which really I think really hones all of this. So it's individualism. I think Australia has adopted the individualism that has, just gone through the roof in America, and we've really bought into all of that. Again, as a result of opulence, because, that accumulative mindset works, when there's money floating around. But Vivek Murthy, who's the Surgeon General, he wrote a book called Together. It was sort of shortly after COVID, I think. But he was writing about how tribal kind of thinking, when we're in a crisis, what happens is we actually have to create another. And so we really lock down into us versus them thinking, and we have to create a other out there if there isn't one already. And that's what's happening in Trump's America. There's just no ability to be able to go, we can actually be here and there can be actually cooperation with the other. We've got to actually create them into the enemy. And that's where the scapegoating comes in with migrants, with Jewish people, with Arabs as well. There's always this scapegoating in those kinds of cultures, which of course means that you can't actually have healthy, robust community building conversations. That is another factor. And again, it's the central theme here is individualism.
What do you mean by individualism there? Because I associate as something of an individualist myself and a civilly libertarian minded person, I associate a lot of the rise of groupthink and tribalism with a decline of the brave, courageous individual and the rise of people conforming into subgroups, where for me, Trumpism is a populist, nativist, blood and soil groupthink about who gets to be in the group of the legitimate American versus who is in the outgroup of the illegitimate American. And similarly, the derangement of the left over the past decade has been about micromanaging the groups of historically disadvantaged and marginalized communities to squabble over a finite pie for which hierarchy of privilege versus underprivilege, or oppressor versus oppressed, or colonizer versus colonized gets to enjoy a certain ranking in a hierarchy of groups. And for me, it would be liberating if everyone was just a little bit more individualistic in the way that I understand the term. But that's not how you're using it, I assume.
No, I do use it in that term. I just disagree with you. I actually do think that individualism has produced that Trumpian type of thinking, which is all about in individual rights. It's all about me, me, me. And it's all about certain people getting ahead of everybody else. It's not about bringing everybody up together. That's certainly not what they're thinking about there. And that individualist thinking has then observed what the woke left have been doing and see that as tribal. And, you know, really, I will pair back wokeism, and I really hate the way that it's been appropriated, misappropriated, inverted, and so on over the last couple of years. But at its core, it's really meant to be about being alive to making sure that everybody gets a fair go at life, right? And so that's a collectivist way of looking at things. When you're an individualist, you see that as anothering. You see that as a form of tribalism. And it's like, well, no, it's about bringing everyone along together. So I actually do think that hyper individualism has fragmented even collectivist thinking and turned wokeism into a tribal kind of, you know, groupthink movement. Now, of course, what's then happened is that the woke left has then obviously got tribal to actually, you know, sort of combat what's been happening. So it's been a to and fro. I'm not saying wokeism doesn't have its faults. It certainly has become highly problematic, but we've got to remember where it all started from. So that's what I would say has been going on. I think this.
I mean, I'm certainly with you. I think we would certainly agree that, like, the whole concept of wokeness has now become an abused notion that the right just uses to beat up on anything that they don't like. But would you say, for example, that the French far right is individualist?
That the French far right is what?
Is individualist?
Look, I think it's not quite as individualist as what's happening in the US, but no.
Because I see the far right and Trumpism as groupy, collectivist, populist ideas of reframe. You're right that they are individualist to the extent that they are not universalist, right? They're not universalist in a traditional old school left wing sense of, like, all humans are created equal and we should lift everybody up and care for the lowliest among us and, you know, give the shirt off our own back in order to help the pauper and all that sort of stuff. They're not universalist or progressive in that sense. But they're not focused on the sanctity of the individual either. They're all about drawing borders between groups of people. And in that sense, they're collectivist. There are who's in and who's out, who belongs here and who doesn't, who has the right to be here and who doesn't, who fits in and who doesn't, who has an alien religion like Islam, who has, you know, weird habits like the Haitians who are eating cats and dogs, like, who, you know, it's all about tribe. It's all about enforcing borders of a tribe because they regard the world as being this globalist cosmopolitan melange of nonsense that, you know, is going to spin out of control unless they reassert groups.
But what I would say is that individualism actually created the realm, the world, where somebody like Trump can rise to power. What he's doing now is creating a cult-like tribal, as you say, mindset to win. Now, I don't think it's about bringing up everybody together. It's really about the elites. It's about, you know, ironically, given that that's what he criticizes, it's really about bringing his oligarchical mates along for the ride. So it is individualism that created it. And back to that Vivek Murthy point is when you get to a crisis point, then everybody has to survive by going tribal. So that's what we're seeing in the US is this tribalism that's in place. Now, before all of this was happening and things were calmer, you had the collectivists and you had the individualists, right? And in a individual unit, as a, you know, a family member, Josh, you have two sort of forces going at play. You have your individualism, and this is how we operate as humans, where we've got to look after ourselves and our offspring and our immediate circle because that's actually in our interest. However, we don't have fangs. We don't run fast. We don't have poison in our tail. The only thing we've ever been able to do to survive as a species and reach the top of the food chain is to cooperate. So we've essentially lived in this tension between individualism and collectivism all throughout our existence. And we have community leaders to ensure that one doesn't too out of control, because when it's in balance, we survive as a species. And what happened since the 1970s, as sort of neoliberalism started to come in, is that we got rid of all of those leaders and those sort of boundary makers. I call them the umpires on the footy field of life. So we got rid of unions. We got rid of, we can even say, religious leaders, moral thinkers, the various sort of stopgaps that would actually ensure our individualism didn't take over and stop the collective thinking preserving us. So what's happened now, we've arrived in 2025 without any of these umpires actually keeping the game fair. It's like playing without an umpire and without rules. It is no longer fun. It's hell for leather. It goes Roman Empire, you know, kind of arena style kind of battle. And then you, and then what happens is you've got to go tribal. That's where So that's what sort of neoliberalism got rid of, is all those checks and balances. And,
I think there are, two things happening there that you're pointing to. One is the decline of the group and the rise of the individual. But then I think it's actually a separate move to remove the umpires. Because the first thing is not just about removing umpires. It's about, I remember there was this book, I don't know if you remember, around the turn of the millennium, there was a book that was briefly viral called Millennium. And it was a big hardcover coffee table book. And it was about the, it was sort of like, the, if you imagine the Yuval Noah Harari of the time, right? And it was, I remember one line in it, which was, they were the author was comparing the Enlightenment to the discovery of nuclear power, and saying that the Enlightenment and individualism and individual rights, for the first time, split the social atom and unleashed the ferocious power of the individual, in the same way that nuclear energy, you know, split the physical atom and unleashed all that power. And that, I think, was a welcome thing. I mean, I think that gave a lot of the dissenting heterodox ideas that gave rise to human rights and the franchise for women and a whole bunch of other things, and an end to racism and so on. But more recently, I see what you're saying about the decline of fair umpires and an increasingly rigged system that has given rise, that, or is, that has left a space in which cynical people like the Donald Trumps of the world can step into it, criticizing oligarchs while he himself is an oligarch, criticizing plutocrats while he himself is a plutocrat, criticizing the rigged system while he himself is the biggest rigger of any system, criticizing, you know, the elites who don't listen to the little man while he enriches himself and his family at the expense of the little man. But the only reason he can plausibly make the case is because he is pointing to a real thing that has happened since probably the 80s, which is that the working poor have been disempowered, and, you know, regional towns have had their hearts ripped out, and the church has declined, and there is destabilization, and globalization has had impacts, and we just haven't dealt with any of that as well as we might have, and now we're suffering the consequences. Yeah.
So I mean, it's going around in all kinds of circles, but this is exactly how complex systems go. And that's, as you know, what my latest book is about, which I wrote on Substack as a serialization, has now been picked up by Penguin in the US to be published next year. But I explain all of these complex systems. So, I mean, if we take a linear moment in time, sure, we can have this argument that, you know, individualism, we need to return to it because it's the thing that stops these tribal ways of going about things. But it's a complex system, and we've arrived precisely at this point as other complex civilizations before us. So I don't know if you know about this. I've been rattling on about it for ages. We probably covered it at some point at one of our dinners or something. But every complex civilization throughout history has collapsed. And we are in the process of collapse. We're in the sixth stage. There's generally sort of six stages that have been marked out by historians. And we're in the sixth stage. And this is what it looks like. And it's precise. It happens the same way around. Rampant individualism leads to an anti-intellectualism that then leads to a essentially this era of frivolity, narcissism, you know, fake news, literally. This has sort of happened in the Roman Empire, the Mayan Empire, and so on. So there's a whole range of factors that play out after these other things have played out. And it's a pattern that we, the most boring, predictable kind of species on the planet, we do it over and over again, and we have not learned our lessons. And we're playing, you know, it's playing out exactly as it has before and as the historians warned us it would. And it is individualism that will kick it off. There's a range of different factors. The thing that will actually tip is usually a climate crisis or, and oh, what's his name? Peter, the polymath who wrote a book. My God, it's too early in the morning for me to remember. The Russian polymath. He wrote a book about how collapse, the thing that triggers it is inequality. Inequality is the thing that will tip a civilization. It's the ultimate kind of trigger point. There'll be all these other things going on, but it's the thing that will tip the civilization over the edge.
Peter Turchin,
thank you very much. That's exactly
Well, that was one of our Substackers, Carola. Thank you, Carola.
Oh, thank you, Carola. Oh, Carola, yeah. Carola is one of my followers, and she has probably heard me quote Peter Turchin many times over. he works out of the Austrian Institute of Systems, Complex Systems, and his book was a big bestseller a couple of years ago. But this is how it goes. And it's sort of interesting just sort of seeing how the heterodox movement, which, you know, I'm been a big fan of, but they've gone down this whole, I think, spiral of thinking because they've got trapped in this us versus them thinking, which is precisely what will tip a civilization. And it's exactly what we shouldn't be doing at the moment. So I get disappointed where my former left-thinking brethren have become so anti-woke. And I just don't think that's the issue. I actually think it's the upshot of what has been happening for quite a number of years now. So we need to pull back and see it as a broad systemic issue rather than taking little linear chunks and focusing on those because that's exactly what got us into trouble in the first place. And it's also what's going to prevent us from getting out of the trouble.
I like that you're going back to the fake news in the Mayan Empire. I want to hear what the Mayan fake news was. What the, you know.
It's information and the people who control, you know, the passing on of information. And it's the idea of bullshit, not lying, but bullshit. And, you know, that sort of that writer who wrote the book in the 80s on bullshit, he knew what he was on about, that we were heading in this direction where lying isn't even the problem anymore. It's like an absolute disrespect for truth, which, of course, Trump has eyes. Like,
yeah,
if lying, there's still a connection to the truth. You kind of know that you're going against the truth and you're trying to get away with it. With bullshitting, you've stuck two fingers up to the whole concept of telling anything resembling truth. And that's where we're at today.
Yeah.
That's things that is a six-stage collapse concept.
Daniel says on Substack that the Mayans' fake news was that the world will end in 3012. So apparently there you go. What was it? It was 2012, right? Wasn't everyone running around with their hair on fire saying that the Mayans had predicted the end of civilization in the 90s or something?
Yeah, I mean, there's been so many of these things, and at dinner parties, this is what they brought to throw back at me. But hasn't there always been someone like you saying the world's going to come to an end? And I'm like, yes, I suppose the difference is today in 2025, we have modelling that has been done for many, many years, done by huge, think tanks and institutes, showing that this is how it goes. This is, you know, the systems are already in play. I mean, population collapse is probably the best example to show that there's no reversing it now. You know, we are going to go through massive population decline in a couple of decades. And of course, that's going to have a ripple on effect for the economy, for stability, democracy, all of that.
Are you talking about the declining birth rates in the West?
The declining birth rates around the entire world. The actual population.
But most environmentalists say that that's welcome and it should happen quicker. I mean, they're still having babies in Africa and Latin America, but the rate of increase is declining, but we're still creating a lot of people.
Yeah, worldwide, the global numbers the replacement rate globally is well below the 2.1 required. We're at 2.1.
No.
Or where globally it's about 2.4, but it's going to actually be going down. But what's important here is that some of the biggest players in our global civilization are actually below replacement rate. So South Korea's currently at 0.7. Most of Europe's 1.4 and 1.6. And once you go below replacement, you can't come back up again. So Africa's replacement rate is going down. So it's currently at 4 point something. There are some nations that are going up. Ironically, it is a result of malnutrition and increasing famine and poverty. People tend to have more children in those times, but it's a small blip that will probably then, you know, go back down the other way. But India's only just above replacement. China's below replacement. So massive swaths of the world.
But Sarah, you're now sounding like the Christian conservatives who say that we should all have lots of babies because we're in an inexorable civilizational decline. And I'm been forced into the position of the progressive small L liberal who says, well, we'll just import. Well, I believe in immigration and we'll figure out a way around it. But I don't think it's an invalid concern, but it's definitely, you've got some strange bedfellows there.
Yeah, no, totally. But Josh, you're a man who can handle a hell of a lot of nuance. It's not a,
true.
This is no longer left versus right. You can't work out the camps anymore. I was, you know, grew up with this idea and the population explosion, Paul Elric, you know, we're all doomed because we're all just going to, you know, eat up all the resources. So people say to me, isn't this great for the environment that the population is going to decline in a couple of decades? Well, the problem is it's not going to happen soon enough to make a difference to that, you know, 1.5 degrees above pre-industrial temperature threshold that we're meant to be not surpassing, although we're now in our second year of it. So it's not going to make a difference. It's not going to make a difference to the things, to this deadline that we're on. So everybody, you know, if you sort of take it again as a linear chunk in the whole argument, sure, less people is a great. But the point is, we're not actually going to see a tangible decrease in population. We're going to hit a peak of 9 to 10 billion people in about 2050, and then it'll cut back down the other side radically fast. So by 2050, we'll have gone over that threshold of climate warming. So no, it's not going to make a big difference.
Also, I would just add to that to bolster your case somewhat. The reason why the population crisis is more dire than the climate crisis is because there are conceivable technological solutions to the climate crisis. We're not acting on them fast enough, and you know, a lot of blame to go around there. But you can imagine a universe. You can easily imagine a universe in which technology gets us saves us from the worst of climate chaos. You can't really imagine how technology saves us from the worst of just not having enough people.
Elderly and to fix the bridges and the infrastructure and the crumbling cities. And especially now, I mean, and this is why the conservatives, the Elon Musks and the Trumps and so on, are bringing out these, you know, bridesmaid's tale type fertility policies, which is what they do.
Handmaid's tale.
Yeah.
No, but I mean, but what's wrong with that? Isn't that consistent with your worldview?
No. Because firstly, what I would say is in Hungary, they did it and it made absolutely no dent on fertility or in population replacement rates. You cannot do it in time. If the damage is done, you cannot get back up to replacement levels. And that's been shown through all the modelling. Then the second thing is that trying to solve a problem like this with draconian Orwellian measures ain't going to cut it. It just isn't. It's not addressing the reasons why people aren't having children. And the main reason why the fertility is going down is because of chemicals and sort of pollution problem. You know, the sperm count of men has halved since the 1970s, and there's projections saying...
Yeah, but that's not it, Sarah. That's not it. It's not because people are trying desperately to have children and they simply...
It's a combination.
Get to an IVF clinic. It's because people are choosing not to have babies.
They're choosing not to
have
babies.
As people get richer, they don't want babies as much.
There is that. That's an absolutely valid thing. And I would dig deeper and I would say they're choosing not to have babies because they're also not partnering. There's a big, big pushback from women going, I don't want to have kids. And we go back to the fragmentation that's happening at the moment. And the fragmentation between men and women is real. It's another layer to all of this. And, you know, this is something that I've been writing about on my Substack is the male violence that's going to be coming about. Again, we're bringing in another issue here, but this is how complex systems work. AI is coming in and taking now, you know, increasingly white-collar jobs and taking jobs from men in their middle ages who have been quite comfortable and are not at all used to having, a change in the status quo. And male violence is going to become a huge thing, and disenfranchisement and men feeling redundant. And we're seeing this play out, in TikTok and everything. Young women are absolutely sort of fed up with men. And it's a real problem. It's a real problem. Mm. So look, there's all factors at play here, and they're all converging on each other, but absolutely.
Plastics. No, I mean, but I think we've also collectively failed to be honest about the gender imbalance, in the sense that we've made great inroads in redressing the ways in which women were held back in the past. And it has marked you as some kind of a crazed lunatic anti-feminist if you raise the fact that women are now outperforming men on so many different metrics. They're graduating university at higher rates. They're not dropping out of high school at the same rate. They don't have inflict the same self-harm on themselves. There is a dysfunction in masculinity that is at least in part caused by the crisis of, gender roles. And to simply say, well, they had it coming because they ruled the roost for 1,000 years, doesn't save you when civilization collapses because you have a whole generation of useless young men who are infuriated and enraged.
Yeah, but I think, you can go around in circles with this, and I sort of debate these different things. And in my audience on Substack, I'll get a lot of men, some of whom I've seen their names here, so they can put their hand up if they like, saying, well, what should we do? And I'm like, well, the thing is, and this is what I drill it down to, and I sort of wrote about it in response to the Adolescence movie as well, or Netflix series, I should say. We can drill it down, but eventually we've got to get to a point where we're going to have to do something. We're going to have to do something fast because young boys are suffering. I totally agree with you. The problem is that women are often the ones who actually try to make these kinds of sociological changes. And men are turning to me, to women like me, and going, well, what should we do? What should we do? And notoriously, young boys, especially ones who are suffering, do not listen to women. They just don't, especially, older women. We need men of your generation, Josh, to actually take charge now. And so whether that's going to look like a feminist movement for men, where they're actually going to go, we've got to redress this balance. We're going to have to get, institutional change happening. We're going to have to get cultural perceptions changed. It does need to come from men. What I would say is that every woman I know, if we see men rising up trying to actually help young boys and having these kinds of conversations, we'll be there cheering and supporting. I guarantee
that's not true. That's not true. No, that's not true. You will, because you'll understand the nuance and you'll understand that it's not an attack on you. But coming back to what we were saying earlier about tribalism and groupthink and the you're either with us or against us mentality at the moment, when men do try to step up, it's changing a little bit, but like when men do try to step up and say there is a crisis in masculinity. I mean, it's happened to me a million times on the air, in, at writers' festivals, if I mention it on a panel or something like that. The moderator or some woman takes an easy shot and says, oh, boo-hoo, I think you'll be okay, pet. Yeah, let's all cry some tears for white men, shall we? And they get a huge round of applause. That is just the way that it goes.
I think we're in a time of transition, and this is what's going to have to happen. This is what happens. We're in a time where these ideas, where it's sort of switching over, where we're going to have to change gears and realize we're going to have to use different methodologies, different approaches for young boys. And of course, there's going to be this moment of conflict where somebody on the Writers' Festival panel is going to go at someone like you, for sure. And then there's going to be women like me that going, hang on, no, we need to be discussing this. And what we need to do is bring in different perspectives and la, 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 la. So this is inevitable. It's a massive seismic shift. This is what happens. This is where the ideas get juicy and interesting. What I'm saying is we need to see more men like you. Like, don't give up. Like, women in the 1920s didn't give up on us. They were out there fighting. They gave up their lives, literally, so that women like me could be sitting here talking to you, So we've got to remember that these things take hard work, dedication, and really, really tricky times. So this is what I'd say, get out there. Start doing this now.
I get it. And listen, let me make the point clearer. One of our Substack subscribers, Nola, just said, Josh doesn't seem to know many good women or hasn't looked hard enough. The point here is the heckler's veto. Or the terrorist's veto.
Yeah.
It's not about most women and it's not about most men. It's about a dynamic that we have created in which the there are certain taboos which leave you extremely vulnerable to an attack which marks you as being on the other side or on the side of hate speech or something. So the moment you articulate this, we have a context for the bully woman, the heckler woman, to throw a, it only takes one person out of 100 to shoot you down. And the consensus is that they're on the right side and you're on the wrong side because you represent, you know, making excuses for traditionally privileged guys like dumb, pale, stale males, and they're fighting the good fight on behalf of traditionally marginalized communities like women. So, yeah, it's a groupthink thing. It's not about I don't know enough great women. I know heaps of great women. The problem is that they are also afraid to speak up because they know the taboos that are associated with social justice dogmas.
One thing I would say is that the groupthink thing and the sort of these labels, and this is, you know, not a direct attack here. I'm couching my terms a little bit. But I find that just a way that actually, I think when we started to put labels onto these scenarios, these complex scenarios, it actually limits the debate. I actually think, you know, I think that people are scared and they're trying to work out these things. And sure, there's a dump on. This is what humans do. They do a dump on until somebody in the public eye like you or me or whoever can say calmly, and rather than kind of getting reactive, can actually say calmly, I totally see your point. I feel for you. And we need to probably progress this debate in a different direction, and boys are suffering and we need to start la, 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 la. So part of what we're being challenged with at this juncture in history is also talking differently, communing differently, and not playing into the very things that landed us in this problem in the first place, which is that adversarial, us versus them, tribal thinking. So I'm really careful about using words like groupthink and woke and all this kind of thing, partly because they've been misappropriated, but also because it's not helpful. I think those women, you know, who sort of speak up like that, they're coming from a place of pain and hurt and fed upness. Like, because like the other side of all of this, when boys are not in a great place, it's shit for everyone, right? I mean, Donald Trump is a little boy chucking his toys out of the cot, right? And we're all having to suffer. And so this is something that we've got to bear in mind. You know, women have a tough time and they go off and take drugs in the, you know, in the suburbs and basically, you know, live these miserable lives. Men go through a tough time and women get raped and there's violence and there's, you know, freaking World War III. So that's, we've got to bear all in mind.
Certainly. No, I mean, I take that point. You know, I would also add that when men are in a rough time, they don't just rape and kill women, they kill themselves at triple the rate that they kill anyone else. And I take your point about, what's that?
A lot. It's still destruction. Yeah.
Yes, totally. I mean, of course I have faith in our capacity to say, I hear what you're saying and I disagree respectfully in this respect, because I have a show called Uncomfortable Conversations that seeks to do precisely that. And I don't mean to elevate or empower the concept of groupthink or tribalism more than it warrants. I think that when I talk about it, I only talk about those phenomena in order to be able to pinpoint a part of the conversational problem that we have or the challenge that we have in order to empower people to push back against it or to notice when it's happening, which is that we've inherited a bunch of taboos. The taboos are being enforced by bullies who posture as disenfranchised, you know, seekers of justice. And that is the source of their bullying, which is not necessarily an overt ability to exclude people from the public square, but the ability to shame people into not believing they have a right to speak up with their own opinion and to call out what they see as being their truth, because it contravenes or contradicts a set of norms, whether we're talking about on the left, those will be social justice norms. Those might be beliefs about biological sex. They might be beliefs about the ability of certain migrant communities to integrate. They might be beliefs about the LGBTQIA+ community. They might be whatever, any of these, you know, Indigenous Australians, any of these things that are really difficult to talk about without falling into one preset camp or another. And on the right, they have their whole set of taboos. In many ways, they're more censorious and much more, you know, the right invented cancel culture. It was pulling off McCarthyism and, you know, the Crusades and banning violent video games in the 80s and trying to have The Life of Brian, cancelled from movie theaters long before wokeness or cancel culture was even a thing. So this is definitely not one side or the other. But I'm joining you in calling for greater courage in standing up to and calling out people who misuse their platforms in order to try to curtail the things that we can talk about, even when they seem to be doing so for good reasons.
I would argue, I totally understand the role of that. And I have championed it and supported it and being fascinated by that, the heterodox, you know, kind of way of thinking about things. What I would say is we're now at a point where we're going to have to move on, as in we need to actually find better ways, because this way is not working. And we've gone into an antagonistic, adversarial way of thinking. And, you know, in my book, I write about the idea of Moloch, with the game theory concept. It comes from the Hebrew Bible, the God that if you sacrificed your child, God of Moloch would give you a win on the battlefield, right? Which is the ultimate irony. You actually want the wins on the battlefields to save your children, and yet you're sacrificing your children. Anyway, this is Moloch, right? This kind of ultimate catch-22 situation where a small sacrifice, right, basically to get a small win, a sacrifice that you make to get a small win, ends up fucking us all over. And look, the ultimate example of that I use to explain it, it's not the ultimate example, it's a simple example, is you're at a concert and somebody in the second row stands up to get a better view. And then everybody behind them's got to stand up. And then by the end of the concert, everyone's standing up and everyone loses because they've got, you know, they didn't get to sit and be comfortable for the concert. And that's what's been playing out with the AI race, with the nuclear race, with pretty much everything that's happening in the world today. One person got up and made a sacrifice, you know, and ended up seeing us all losing. And so, you know, this is where we're at with the nuclear race at the moment. Everybody's got to invest in nuclear. We're all stuffed. And this is what's happening with kinds of conversations around the place now. One person started talking in antagonistic, adversarial, us versus them kind of words, and then everybody had to join in at that level. And that's where we're at. We're at this point where we're all just quibbling and squabbling backwards and forwards in a really immature, unproductive way. And what I feel that people like you and I should be doing, our responsibility is to shift that. We need to shift a yes and way of going about things rather than a yes but way of going about things.
Finish the thought.
No, I just, I feel that we really, this is the only way forward. Otherwise, we're going to be stuck in this semantic shit, this Moloch kind of cycle, and nothing's going to shift.
I agree with you that I think what I'm picking up on, and correct me if I'm wrong, is a sense of frustration with, small L liberals constantly banging on about how stupid lefties are for going on about woke social justice nonsense, like criticizing that, right? We get it, like putting pronoun, big corporations forcing employees to put their gender pronouns in their email signatures is a little bit extra, but like we don't need to keep focusing on that when there's a legitimate threat to democracy and global civilization, right? Here's my only response to that, as someone who has been guilty in his day of trying very, very hard to call out the left on focusing on bread and butter issues. My only response to that would be, to the extent that we didn't focus on that enough, we ended up with the Make America Great Again movement and Donald Trump. I worry about the left losing its sense of universalism and its commitment to economic justice and its fixation on identity politics. Not because I think it's the biggest problem in the world, it's not even close. But if it allows a space in which the center and the center right feel that there is no left for them to vote for and end up fleeing into the arms of autocrats because they don't think that the left is making sense on a bunch of common sense issues about biology and immigration or whatever, then it's a big fucking deal whether or not you put your gender pronouns in your email signature, right? Like that for me is what's at stake. What's at stake is we are losing elections we should not be losing. There is absolutely no reason why Donald Trump should have won the last election in the United States. And I'm not monocausal about this. I understand there was inflation, there was a lot, you know, there was Biden, there was all this. But at the end of the day, it shouldn't be that hard to create a center-left party that can articulate to its traditional base of the working class a message of economic empowerment without tying itself up in knots about whether or not transgender prisoners are going to get free healthcare.
I would say at this point in a complex civilization's decline, yes, it is that hard. And I also get upset when people just go at the Democrats or at, you know, sort of various left-leaning parties around the world going, you've done us all over. They're in the same position as the rest of us. We're all in this weird race to the bottom battle, right, that none of us want to be in. And I think rather than, again, pointing the finger and trying to find someone to blame, we need to say there's no one to blame and yet we're all to blame. And that kind of level of complexity is a mind fuck, but we need to actually accept that to be able to move on. So that's the only thing I would say there. I feel the same. I do feel the same way. I scratch my head going, well, more than scratch my head, I, you know, bang my head against a wall going, what the hell? How did this? Yeah, we also observed, Josh, people giving people like AOC a hard time, Bernie Sanders a hard time. Anyone who does come out and get radical and meet the times with an actual stance, which is appropriately outraged and revolutionary, is shot down. So this is where we're at. We are in this state of flux where we're going to have to accept all of these things are going on. I issue the challenge to everybody listening out there is to not get caught up in the bifurcation, because that is going to make it worse and worse and worse. We need to have more softness, more empathy, more understanding, and more hardcore progressive thinking, like truly progressive thinking, and actually get out there and collectivize again. I'm not talking socialism. Like if somebody hits me with that, I'll bloody be pissed off. But it's about we've got to communicate. We've got to get out of this prisoner's dilemma that we're in, where we're all going down because we're not collectivizing. That is the only thing that keeps the human species going forward. So until we can actually get those skills honed again, in the absence of the church, the scouts movement, all those umpires on the footy field of life, we're going to have to do it without the philosophers, without the intellectuals. It's going to have to be people like you and I. It's going to have to be people like who are listening and shooting.
We are the philosophers and the intellectuals. Don't talk yourself down, Sarah. We are the modern day sages, for fuck's sake.
Well, we're as close as our society is going to get.
Look, I mean, one thing that, and to all of the people who are just joining in the middle of the throes of this fabulous conversation, you're meeting Sarah Wilson. If you're coming from my side of the fence, you should subscribe to her because she's someone who is actually up for having these conversations and for trying to interrogate what it means to live in the 21st century. So do that. And if you're coming from her side of things and you like this, then obviously subscribe to Uncomfortable Conversations. This is my whole métier, having conversations with interesting people about some of the most provocative ideas fearlessly and hopefully not tribally. Your mate Carola says, I wish more people could have conversations like this, listening to the other person's point of view and trying to find common ground and respectfully disagreeing. Great. So go subscribe to both of us. You'll get a double dose. Daniel says, that's a question on population collapse. I'm going to come back to that before we wrap. But I wanted to talk about something you said earlier, Sarah, on bullshit, because I think this is important to really underline. The whole dictator's playbook, like the Putin script, is you don't require people to necessarily believe that the lies you tell them are true, but you so muddy the notion of truth. You pointed at this earlier, so I'm just reiterating what you said, but I just wanted to clarify it, that you so muddy the whole idea of there being such a thing as truth or falsehood that people kind of just abandon their fidelity to even thinking that it cares, that they should care about that question. And I think once you do that, then people are totally malleable. And one of the things that I really worry about, both politically and also culturally, is not just the bad actors, the obvious bad actors like the Putins and the Trumps, who clearly are full of shit, but the ways in which we are encouraged socially and culturally and politically to pretend that we believe things that we don't really believe, or that we maybe sort of believe, or that we believe to the extent that we believe that we ought to profess our belief in them. But like, be brave, grow a pair, like stand up and assert your truth. And like you were saying about the French three-year-old on the back of a bicycle, engage in some back and forth and train ourselves to disagree and to throw ideas around in a free space where we know that we're not going to be demonized for making a mistake. I think that's critically important.
Yeah, Hannah Arendt, if anybody's listening and wants to kind of read some good philosophy out there that's very relevant for the times, Hannah Arendt wrote about this, and she was obviously, she was Jewish, and she escaped Nazi Germany, went to Paris, then she had to escape Paris or France when the Nazis arrived, and she went to the US. And she eventually came back, of course, and wrote, what's his name? Eichmann.
Eichmann in Paris, right?
Jerusalem.
Or in Jerusalem.
Yeah. So she went to the trial of this Nazi general. And it's where the banality of evil phrase comes from, because he was just this everyday guy who was saying, I just follow orders, blah, 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 blah. Anyway, she writes a lot about what was happening back then. And it's very, you know, pertinent to what's happening today. But one of the things she said is that bullshit, the absolute evasion, like undermining of truth, is basically what brings a society down. When you can no longer, there's no stable stakes in the ground that you can hang on to as a culture, as a society. And so it's, and then it becomes just, you know, a molecule kind of all, you know, no holds barred kind of thing, situation. You know, it's that, you know, it's like the sporting game with no rules. It just becomes very, very unfun and dangerous, you know. So,
yeah.
I think it's a really fundamental thing that you're picking up on there, Josh, that when we no longer care about truth, we're fucked. We really are.
And you know what? It actually doesn't take a huge amount of courage. It's one of those things where, what do they say about courage? I sometimes say this to my kids, so I should probably get it right, that courage is not feeling fear. It's feeling the fear and doing it anyway. And that the fear actually is greater before you've done the thing. And then once you're doing it and you're learning and you're, you know, in the aftermath, even if you fall flat on your face, it's never as terrifying as before you do it. I think we'd all be a lot better if we were just a little bit braver conversationally.
I try to give to people to actually go to that point is I describe it as like when you're climbing a tree as a kid. You know, it's always good to put into kid analogies, but you know, you climb the tree and you can stay close to the trunk, right? And it's all cozy and it group thinky and everybody's kind of a bit foggy headed because it's a bit suffocating and everybody's trying to play it safe, right? You only really start to come online as a human when you go out on the branch and you go out to the furthest limbs and you're out there amongst the foliage. And it's only there that you can look out and see that you're standing in one tree amongst many. And you can see that there's a world out there and there's a whole range of complex, like interconnected systems going on. And you can actually feel the breeze. And then you've also got to fend. You've got to use all of your primal muscles and cognitive abilities to stay stable on this sort of, you know, wobbly platform out there, you know, in the breeze. And that is how I see going about a life. You can hang out at the trunk and just get swamped and fed these boring, suffocating ideas, or you can go out on the limb, so to speak, and you can actually, you know, a bunch of different philosophers and thinkers call it going to the edge. You know, Pema Chodron, the wonderful Buddhist nun, she says the edge is where you're meant to be, right? At that point, we're meant to be at that point, fighting for things, living things, being agile, fending. I call it fending in my last book. We're meant to be drawing on those very human skills to feel fully alive. And as, you know, an artist, you know, I sort of very much know I need to go to that edge to really come up with ideas that are going to connect with humanity. You, as a provocateur, you know you need to go to that edge. We all need to go there. And that's actually where we need to be at the moment to fight for things, but also to, most importantly, and this is the most important fight we need to be doing at the moment, is the fight for our humanity, because that is what is being eroded here. The bullshit, the fake news, but equally AI. AI is really, and this is the gift of AI, actually, is it's actually getting us to think about what makes us human. All right, so if it's not our work, if it's not the ability to seduce somebody, you know, online, if it's not this, what is it that makes us human? We're having to ask that now because we have been stripped of everything else. You know, it's happening now, not because we're not fighting for it. So it's a really interesting time to be alive. And I'm with you, Josh, like find your courage because this moment is going to, we happen to be the adults born into this time in history. It is a difficult time in history. It's like game on. We've got to get out there. We are the adults in the room. We're not the children. No one's going to come and save us. This is our moment.
I love it. I love that that analogy about the tree as well and about the edges. On Substack, Sarah writes, in permaculture, you always work from the edges because that's the most fertile areas. That's a nice analogy. Serena says, try doing a master's in Australia. Nobody wants to debate a thing or to disagree, which is a sad indictment, perhaps, of academia in Australia. Shelley says, Australian opulence and individualism, like what you were talking about before, Sarah, is explored wonderfully in the social researcher Hugh Mackay's book, The Way We Are, Lessons from a Lifetime of Listening. Yeah, he's a really interesting writer. And I said that I would, also shout out to Gary, who is in Minneapolis, and our hearts go out to everyone there after this assassination. Gary says, here in Minneapolis, a person just killed a leading politician and her husband, also severely wounded another politician and his wife in their homes. In the latter case, their little daughter managed to call for help. We've entered into necropolitics and brutalism. We have plenty of guns and bullets, but too little deep connection and conversation. Hear, hear, Gary. Lastly, I said I'd get back to Daniel, who says, is population collapse, coming back to your point, Sarah, a problem for civilization or just for growth economics? Yeah. Do you see a future in which there's a stabilization at a lower zero growth rate?
Well, it's not even a matter of whether we're heading there, whether we like it or not. Like, that's the thing. And most modeling shows that we'll probably stabilize around about 3 to 4 billion. It'll take a couple of hundred years.
Sarah, man, we did well. I just lost you halfway through that brilliant speech. I don't know how much the viewers got, so just assume they got it, but maybe just reiterate the final couple of things that you were saying.
Yes, population decline is going to have a huge impact on the economy. So yes, that is the system that'll be mostly impacted, which is why the bros and Trump and everyone are really worried about it. They need people buying their items. You know, they need our attention. They need more attention going into their products. But it's going to have a ripple on effect for absolutely everything else. You know, if we don't have taxpayers, then who's going, and we don't have young people coming through the system, who's going to look after us when we're older? We're going to have a whole lot of sick people. Who's going to actually look after the hospital's infrastructure? You know, it's going to have a huge, the main thing I worry about, and this is what I talk about in my book, the mass civil unrest element in all of this is the thing that we need to be keeping an eye on. So we as humans are very resilient. We have handled all kinds of disasters throughout history, all kinds of declines and so on. But the problem is it's about how we handle things. And because we've lost all of our collectivist infrastructure, we're like an open wound without an ability to form a scab. We're basically so exposed to what's about to hit us. We've got no skills. We've got no ability to go and meet our neighbours and cooperate and collaborate, because that's what we're going to need. So to answer Daniel's question, yes, it's an economic issue, but it's a civilizational issue very shortly after. And that's what...
Let me end by saying, can you do away with the word collectivist? Because it comes with so much baggage. I know that you mean it well, but it also means communism and socialism and a whole bunch of other stuff that you don't intend it to mean. Communal, collective, maybe.
Okay. I'll do that if you can drop the group thing.
It's a deal. It's a deal. What's a better word for it? Because I really don't mean to necessarily
come into our conversations. Maybe that's a good.
Yes. Yes. What is a good synonym for for groupthink?
I actually just missed that last bit. Sorry. Oh, my brother just joined. Simon Wilson.
Ah, Simon.
Like my brother.
I was just asking, what is a good alternative word for groupthink? I think we're losing each other, aren't we? Doesn't matter. All right. Okay. I love you, Sarah. Next time we'll be in person and we will actually be able to entertain each other in the flesh. Thank you to everyone for watching. Yep. We'll wrap it up. Subscribe to Sarah's Substack. Subscribe to my Substack. Do it now before you forget. Just subscribe to the free versions and then you can always keep us in your pocket. Thank you, Sarah. Thanks. Thanks to all. Lots of love. See ya.
So sorry about the internet.
That's okay.